Hey guys, welcome to another episode of The Orange Card. This episode, however, is a little bittersweet for all of us here, seeing as now that both Syracuse team seasons are officially over, we're finishing up for the year. First off, let's say hi to our team, Aaron Fish.
Hello.
Jared Bomba.
Hey.
And Will Moya.
What's up, guys?
And for the last time, how was everyone's week?
I got to start with a couple really important shout-outs. This is very important to me. First of all, Mary Washington men's soccer winning the CAC championship. One of my good friends, Max Watson, is an assistant coach. That's a big win for them. Franklin & Marshall field hockey, Centennial Conference Championship on Sunday. And Franklin & Marshall men's soccer claiming a second Centennial Conference Championship on Sunday as well. Huge shout out to Coach Wagner and the boys down in Lancaster. That's 9 straight trips to the conference tournament, 5 straight trips to the NCAAs. Big day for the Diplomats. Also, Newhouse Seagulls, 4 unbeaten in a row.
Yes.
Doing pretty well.
Unbeaten, I think we tied, but I'll take the tie.
With 4 unbeaten, I think that puts us top of the power rankings, right?
I think so. I don't know. Does it?
I had the opportunity to play with the Seagulls, and I'm hoping that more come in the future because I actually had a lot of fun.
And you played pretty well.
Yeah, you had like that. You had like 27 saves that game. It was pretty remarkable.
Thanks, guys.
As I said before, so both Syracuse seasons are now officially over, so we'll take a look at how the men did in the ACC tournament and kind of project forward for both teams as they head into a winter break. In U.S. news, the U.S. women, they've announced a team for their final matches of the year against Canada, and the MLS is now headed to conference finals. And as always, we'll wrap up the top 10 things that happened in world soccer, and finally, a special guest will see us through our final stoppage time of the season. So we'll start with the men tonight, seeing as they played this week. They drew against Clemson in the ACC tournament. They still had a chance to kind of claim a tournament berth by making a good run, but having played the Tigers to tight 2-1 defeat a few weeks ago, Syracuse would have felt they could play them close, and that's exactly what they did. Back and forth, 2-2 tie ended in penalties, with Clemson winning 4-3 after 6 rounds of penalty kicks, which was kind of insane. That marks 2 years in a row that the Orange were eliminated by Clemson on penalties in the ACC tournament. This year, however, Syracuse won't be getting an invite to the national tournament. We'll talk about the shootout first. Now, generally speaking, what happened there with the shootout?
Well, Clemson got to go first, and that's huge. You always want to choose to go first because you get to put the pressure on.
One interesting thing about the penalty shootout was that SU goalkeeper Hendrick Hilpert was one of the 5 initially to take a penalty. Confidence must have been high for him. Even though he gave up 2 goals during the game, for a goalie to step up, it throws everyone off, and maybe that was his plan.
On the other side of things, goalkeepers, they probably kick the ball more than almost any other field player. They're typically pretty good ball strikers. I know when I was playing in college, our goalkeeper TJ White took penalties for us in a couple games, so it's not too uncommon.
I was gonna say the same thing. I have most of my goalkeeper friends have taken PKs for us because they know PKs more than anybody else. They know what goalkeepers want to see. They know which way goalkeepers dive, so they pretty much know a PK more than anybody else.
I totally agree with both those points. I'm just saying that, you know, I've surprised me the level of intensity this game was at this point to see Hilpert step up. Give him all credit. He scored, and he scored one of the 3 goals. So there were strikers that missed.
Given the intensity of the game that you said, Will, I thought one of the interesting things was that Lucas Rubio, who hadn't played that much for Syracuse, was in the first 5 penalty kick takers for the Orange. And frankly, I thought he took the best penalty out of everyone. He really is hips, you know, through the goalkeeper one way. He finished easily to the right. I don't know. That seems like a more bizarre thing to have a player who didn't play that many minutes, wasn't in the flow of the game, take a penalty.
But that's another thing that tends to happen. As you get towards the end of the season, you start to practice PKs during practice time. You come up with PK takers. You come up with an allotted time at practice where you have your set PK takers take those shots. And whoever does it best, you put them out there. And Lucas Rubio must have been one of those players to step up.
Now the Orange, they had a 1-goal lead, and it was kind of wiped out before a late equalizer goal. The 2-1 scoreline would have been pretty familiar for them. That's what they have. Now, how did the game shake out?
4 second-half goals in the game, pretty intense. Tejan scores. SU get that surprising 1-0 lead. But Clemson scored in 70th and 86th minute. And I was watching the game with Peter, And we were kind of saying, this is the same old Syracuse. They, you know, have a shot, and then they squander two late goals. Away from home, we weren't too sure.
I mean, you thought it was going to be one of those 2-1 games like they've had all season long. And then the tying goal with 2 minutes left in the game, crazy, crazy finish to the game. Peels had the game-tying goal. And it was crazy to me that he had the game-tying goal and then he missed the PK to eventually end the season for them.
Well, not just that, but we just – rewatching that goal, they played it over and over again. It was reviewed, and we were just talking about how, whether it was a goal or not, whether there was a foul or not. I think that also had a lot to do going into, he scores the goal. He thinks, okay, I brought this to a tie. We're going overtime, which eventually led to penalty kicks. And I personally think that possibly could have had an effect on his momentum going in to the penalty kicks.
It's so funny. You guys kind of hinted at how you were thinking that this was playing out just like every other game for them this year. They kind of avoided that. Getting this goal from Peels gave them that second goal, and I was thinking they had maybe avoided the same old negative plot, but in a weird way, losing in penalty kicks just made the exact same thing happen in an even more frustrating manner. So let me take you through it. They fight, but Hugo Delamel, he's got all the technique down, and he comes up short in the penalty kick shootout. That's kind of an allegory for the rest of the year. Kamal Miller started off the season really strong, fails toward the end. That's a little bit of an allegory for the season. He missed two. Hagman, steady all the way through. Sounds like the season. And then at the end, for Peels to do everything right on that penalty kick. He struck it well, beat the keeper, and have it just narrowly come up short. That's also kind of an allegory for the season. The thought the penalty was taken well. I thought Peels had done a lot of really good things through the match. But then to come up just short, it's kind of a sad, remarkable, and recognizable story.
I completely agree with you. That really does show. It really does show a lot about how their season went overall. We all season long, we've been talking about on here how the Orange, they always push through to the end, and then they let up these late goals, and then they just completely lose momentum. And I think that totally loses hope for them. So I think going into this game, I agree with you. I thought it was going to be 2-1. One goal deficit, as it's been, as we've seen pretty often throughout the season. But I think once it came to a 2-2, it was kind of like, I think that gave us more hope, thinking like, oh my God, going into penalty kicks, we were going to have it. And then Peels misses
again.
The shot. Yeah.
They got
exactly.
Us
gave us hope.
So for you guys, who is a player of the season for the Orange?
For me, it was Hendrik Hilpert. A surprising choice in the sense that he only won 6 games, lost 8. So already conference, you know, didn't win a game in conference schedule. But many times throughout the season, you know, the score might have been 2-1, but he kept them in the games. As hard as a goalie, you can do so much. You can make 6, 7, 8 saves. But if they aren't scoring, if there aren't goals being consistently scored in the back of the net, then you're doing all you can. I spoke to Hilpert a few times after some of those home games, and he was just devastated because he felt like he was doing as much as he could, but it just wasn't enough. Definitely kept Syracuse in, and he's going to be a senior leader next year. You know, going in, he'll be a 3-year starter. That's someone that you're really going to want to build around to lead from the back.
My player of the season is 100% Tajon Buchanan. We have brought up his name every single week on this podcast. He's just the kind of player that's fun to watch. He's creative on the ball. He's creative off the ball. He creates so much opportunity for the Orange. And as much as this year things didn't go their way, it's really exciting to think about how much he can grow as a player, because we've said it time and time again. He is only a freshman. And the stuff this kid has as a freshman, he has 3 more years here, and he's just going to be dominant. So the future of Syracuse soccer looks really bright with him.
One thing with Tajon is he scored 4 goals this year. Every game that Tajon scored in, they did not lose, you know, by exception the ACC game against Clemson. But still, when he scores, something might happen. So, you know, I definitely agree with you. Tajon, definitely attacking player for me. Really stood out in his first year for the Orange.
You guys know that I love Tajon Buchanan. And I do think that he is an important player. But if we're looking at what the Orange needed more of and the few sources that they had this year, I would look at Spirit. We talked about players that had good parts of different seasons. Hagman was really strong throughout the middle part of the season. But Mo Adams, for me, player of the season. And he had 9 yellow cards and missed 2 games that way. And that is probably the biggest knock against him. But if you look at where the energy that they lacked all season, if he was their biggest source of it, and if they want to get over the hump with all these close games going forward, it's going to be him maintaining that level and bringing others along with him. So statistically, not the greatest year for Adams, and maybe not the flashiest, but when I look at what they needed most, and that's heart and energy, I think that he was their greatest source of it.
I would have to say Hagman for me. Seeing him, you said he did dominate in the middle of the season. And I think even though he only dominated for a good portion of it, the time that he did, he was absolutely incredible. He was really heavy in the offense, but was able to kind of drop back to the middle and cover the defense as well. And I think that says a lot about overall as a player. Now, looking forward, what needs to change next year?
They need to stop tinkering with the system. They had a lot of new players coming in. We'd see that they'd play one formation the first half and then switch it slightly in the second half. They need to find something that's going to work for their team, and they need to practice that every day. And they need to get in a rhythm, and they need to thrive, and they need to feed the ball forward, and they need to get shots on goal.
I'm a huge fan of feeding the ball forward. I've been saying for weeks that they need to kick it. But I will go for something else being the biggest key this week. There's a quote in Dodgeball where the old guy in the wheelchair says, "You gotta get mean. You gotta get angry." And I think that that's going to be kind of what they're thinking about over the next 9 months. Just talking about Mo Adams. The games where they had that edge, thinking about Clemson the second time around, Virginia, Wake, the games where they had that edge, they prove they can play with anybody. I think that's going to be the biggest and most difficult thing to manufacture during the offseason.
They need to score. 2-1 every single loss this season, 2-1. That just shows how close they were in every single game. They need to learn how to score, how to get that equalizer to win those kind of games.
I completely agree with you, Aaron. That goes what I've been saying all season long. My whole thing is you can take as many shots on goal, but if you don't finish those shots and get the ball in the back of the net, there's no way to do it. But going off of what you said as well, Jared, you have to get mean, you have to get angry. I think that comes with energy. I think towards the end of the season, we saw a completely different Syracuse team. They played with so much energy, so much momentum. They had so much fire going into the game. And I think coming into next year, looking ahead, if they're able to kind of pick up where they left off right now, I think that'll be good for them, especially having such a close game against Clemson.
Tyler, you said something really interesting there, which I think is probably the realest insight out of all of that, which is that all those things kind of lump together. If they can find a little more team unity and identity, and they can bring a little more energy, and they can score a little more and have a little more swagger, all those things are going to contribute to each other. So they're all really important, but I also think that they will all come in bunches as they start to figure one or two of the pieces of the puzzle out.
I mean, everyone's getting one more year with the system. You know, you're going to have Peels returning as a junior, Stangeland as a sophomore, Buchanan as a sophomore. We saw a lot more of Miles Franklin coming off the bench. 3 of his 4 games for Syracuse happened in the last 3 games of the season. So, you know, Coach McIntyre has a lot of time. You're going to have winter offseason practice. The players might get a little bit stronger, a little bit faster. Then come spring, let's see if we get more goals.
Now, what's the biggest positive that they can take from this now lost season?
One big positive for me is that they have the same exact team pretty much going into next season. They only lost 2 seniors, their backup goalkeeper Pat Castle and Mamadou Balde. To train with the exact same team for an entire year going into next season, that's a positive.
I wouldn't be surprised if they try not to see each other a whole lot for the next week or so. I think they need to kind of shake some stuff
you
off. Because it was a struggle of a season.
Yeah.
2 points in the ACC. We can't forget that. Yes, there were few positives.
Talking positives, Will.
But let's turn that into a positive they can use moving forward. They can only improve, really, next season. And
we can hope.
It's the lowest positive there is.
They finished bottom of the ACC. That's a fact. Yeah. So next season, with the same team returning, the same starting 11, they're going to do better. They're going to improve naturally. Let's hope that maybe they qualify for the NCAAs. But let's not be surprised if, you know, a full 9 months, like you said, Jared, under their belts, they get that chemistry going forward.
The only other thing, maybe just one step above that, is that they did do well out of conference. It was reaffirming to have a good out-of-conference schedule. You look at their conference record, 0-6-2. Out of conference, they're 6-2-2. So it's actually one step above the fact that they'll have motivation.
I think the biggest positive for me is the fact that they have so many people returning. They have a really big freshman team. We talked about that at the beginning of the season, and I think that's going to be good for them. They have, like you guys have said, they have a lot of time to kind of piece everything together and keep that chemistry. Now, the women, unfortunately, didn't make the ACC tournament this year, but I think, and I think we all think, that their season can be kind of considered a success given the way that they started and the way that they ended and the foundations that they've kind of built for future ACC runs. They integrated 10 new faces into the team this year, and even though they lose 6 really big, important players as seniors, there's plenty to be positive about going forward. Now, we'll get into the future in a second, but let's look back at the year. What were the positives for Coach Whedon and his team?
8 points in the ACC. We talked all year. We really beat the crap out of the fact that the ACC is the hardest schedule in the conference. But 4 positive results to get 8 points is good. Yes, 7 of those 8 points came from teams that ended up lower in the conference than they did, Syracuse did. But that's where you have to start. If you want to make the conference tournament, you have to beat the teams you should beat. And that's something that the men didn't do this year. So for the women to get those points, steal another point against Clemson, I think that's a step in the right direction. That's something that they maybe won't be proud of, and maybe in 15 years when Syracuse is the best program in the nation, they won't think about this season, but I like to think it's a step in the right direction.
One big positive for this women's team is how young they are, the talent of the younger players, the spine of the team: Taylor Bennett, Shannon Avisa, Georgia Allen, Mackenzie Vlaka, Sydney Brackett, Kate Donovan. We could go on and on. They were the players that you could rely on. I would argue that the senior group and the freshman group really carried the team through this year. So when you have a team, like we just talked about with the men, when you have a team that's so young, that's a good thing to carry over through into the next season.
Tyler, you touched upon the 6 seniors. I think all 6 of them really had an impact off and on the field. I mean, let's run through their names: Sheridan Street, Ava Gordon, Alana O'Neill, Jessica Vigna, Alex LaMontagne, and last but certainly not least, Courtney Brosden. These players are hard to replace, but they did enough. Definitely on the field, we saw their leadership. Probably off the field, too. They'll have rubbed off on the team going forward. They're going to be able to watch, you know, their teammates play, and they're going to do well.
And what can they work on moving forward?
Getting the first goal. I mean, every time SU scored first, they won the game. Yes, there were a lot of young attackers that we just spoke about, but they should be getting chances to get on goal.
Every year, a new freshman class comes in, and they have to adjust to the system. So Jared and I have gone back and forth on Coach Whedon and his system and what he wants to do. So really adjusting to what he wants to do and getting these new freshmen to adjust to his system, and hopefully everything will click and come together so that next year they can function.
For me, the biggest thing is they need to become more composed and comfortable in their attacking third. I've spoken about this a couple times and how I thought that their best games were the games where they were most comfortable operating in that last 30 yards of space. The magic of soccer is that it's not easy to score. And when you do score, it's because something remarkable typically happens. Until they have that comfort level operating in a possession or set piece situation, they're going to struggle to consistently put up goals. And that's the biggest thing facing them. I think we would all agree.
I would argue, though, that scoring goals comes from defending well. So they have to learn how to defend in their system, and when they're able to win the ball in good spots, that's when their attack is going to come.
That's fair. And they did have a couple really good counterattacking moments later in this season, but there is a middle ground there. You can't just go right from defend to counterattack to goal. There's got to be a couple moments of quality every game, and that's only going to come with comfort.
Yeah, and the discipline in actually putting the ball in the back of the net.
Now, just like what we did for the men, who has been your player of the season for the women?
I can't believe you need to ask me this, Tyler. Obviously, Courtney Brosnan, 102 saves.
That shouldn't even have been a question.
Shocker.
For you.
And kind of like Hilbert, it could have been a lot worse. We watched her make dozens of saves that she just pulled the ball essentially out of the net. You know, one of them behind the back, puts it against the post. Praise from all around, from coach, teammates, whatever. We've seen this. And I hope that she continues playing soccer in some level. She got some call-ups a few years ago for the Irish team. Definitely keep involved. That's something I wish I could have done.
I 100% agree with Will. There's honestly, when I look at this team, there's no one else I really could choose. I know there were a lot of players on this team who I think have great skill and had some good moments this season, but every single game, Courtney Brosnan was outstanding. I really, even the game where they lost 7-0, she had some great saves in that game. So there's no one else I 100% agree with you.
And I think Jared and I agree on this one. I'm going to say Taylor Bennett. She can do both offense and defense, and we saw that very well towards the end of the season when Coach Whedon was switching her and Alex LaMontagne back. I think the ability to play as well in defense as you can in offense is incredible, and the shots that she takes from like 30, 40 yards out is just unbelievable to me.
I don't think that she was the best player this year, but if you start talking about player of the season, and considering that this season was about looking forward probably to next year, at some point, probably around the midway point of the season, they kind of knew that. I think that Taylor Bennett is massively important. They're going to lose Jessica Vigna, so they're going to be in need of some center back security early. Shannon Avisa and then Bennett providing that. But if they do elect to keep Taylor Bennett closer to the front of the pitch, scoring goals like she did with that long shot against Miami, she's also going to give them a different dimension attacking-wise. She did certainly for the last 2 to 3 games of the season. And so in terms of flexibility and evolution going forward, I think that that makes Taylor Bennett the player of the season.
As for the future, it does feel somewhat bright for the women's team. We kept asking this season if it would happen, and unfortunately it didn't. Do you all think there's an ACC tournament berth in the future for this women's team?
Yeah, I think so. Coach Whedon believes that there will be, and he believes in this team, and they believe in each other. And if they can push and really work hard, they have some talent. And they're the type of team that they just need to get to that 8th place slot, and it gets better each year. And I really do think that they could do it in the next few seasons.
Aaron, I totally agree with you with that. You know, they only have to get to 8th place. And if they only had a couple more points from few games, they would have gotten there. Definitely with a younger team, we've been speaking about this, a lot of freshmen and sophomores that are going to continue on. And then imagine if we have this conversation next year. You know, what would we be saying? They would only be losing 2 players, none of them being starters. So that's their entire starting 11, kind of like what the men are going this year. So don't be surprised if maybe there's some similarities between SU women in 2018 compared to SU men 2017, but then let's keep looking forward. They'll definitely make it in the next 2 to 3 years.
I think it's hard to forecast exactly what will happen. There's a lot of player development that needs to happen. And fortunately, with a small senior class next year, that player development will have a chance to occur. But looking a little bit further, you start looking at accumulating more points in the ACC each season and recruiting. I think that that's where we're looking 3 to 4, maybe 5, 6 years down the line at the girls who are currently high school juniors. If you're from, you know, this region of the world, you want to play in the ACC, Syracuse is looking like a more attractive option all the time. So they have a chance in the next 2 to 3 years, but I'm hoping that there is a more long-term sustainability built through recruiting over the next 6 years.
I think this team has a lot looking forward. They have a really young team, and I think it's overall in the future it's going to be really well. Well, that's it for SU soccer, not just for this week, but for this season. After the break, we'll take a look at all things US. Welcome back. Let's get to everything U.S. soccer. The United States women's team announced their roster for their upcoming friendlies against Canada on Thursday and Sunday. What did you guys see in Coach Jill Ellis's selection?
One of the big things is Adriana France, NWSL champion, was among the 23 players named. She was named goalkeeper of the year in the National Women's Soccer League and won for the champion Portland Thorns. What's interesting is that she's bringing in four goalies.
Yeah, I was going to say, that is a lot of goalkeepers, I feel like, for friendlies.
Why do you think she's bringing in so many if they're just friendlies?
To test them, maybe?
The only logical thing could be each goalie's going to play 45 minutes, yeah, but that doesn't make much sense. I don't know.
Tobin Heath returning to the roster. She hasn't played for the U.S. since March 7th. She's got 132 career caps. Good to see her back in the mix. And Aaron, you and I were talking about her earlier, how she brings something completely unique to the table. It looks like a baseline snake to a left-footed cross for an, I just remember one of the nastiest goals I've ever seen that she created. She's got that footwork, physicality thing going. She's sick and fun to watch.
We've talked about it. She is just one of those players that the women's game has not seen yet, and she's so much fun to watch. The only concern that I have is that she's coming back from a back injury, and that's always a tough one. Because you really never know when something could happen again. So I'm hoping that she's healthy and ready to go. I mean, I'm sure they wouldn't put her in this situation if she wasn't ready. So I'm really excited to have her back.
Yeah, that's a little nerve-wracking, a back injury. That's kind of scary.
Mm-hmm.
They are notoriously touchy, but it's good to see that the U.S. are taking these friendlies seriously. Canada, not so strong on the men's side, but a very good women's national team. So it'll be a good opportunity for Heath to get some live action against a good team. Maybe all four goalkeepers will get a little action too. We'll see. I guess when you only don't have a couple friendlies a year, you need to make sure that all your keepers are present for the good ones. So maybe that's the thought.
Another interesting point is that the first game is going to be played in Vancouver. So a little different, friendly for the U.S. away from home. So look for that to be maybe some home field advantage for the Canadians.
Not
can't wait to
though.
See.
I thought Vancouver was in America. I mean, it's not, but it kind of is.
whose geography is off, Jared?
I mean, I'm talking like sphere of influence, you know. It's across the Canadian border, but it's basically America.
See, Aaron knows everything about geography, you know.
Kind of like Toronto, just saying.
Now moving to Major League Soccer, the conference finals are all set following some interesting games. Toronto will now face Columbus in the East, while Seattle are facing Houston. Which game stood out for you?
The New York Red Bull Toronto game was super exciting.
It was aggressive.
Very aggressive. Right away. And, you know, Giovinco went down. That led a little bit of fighting. Altidor got a yellow card. New York Red Bull player, Sasha.
Question.
Yes, that one. He got a yellow card, and then the greatest thing ever is they're in the tunnel at halftime, and they both get a second yellow, and they both have to spend the last 45 minutes off the field. Huge implications for both teams. Eventually, it was Toronto that went through, but wow, what a fierce game of football.
It was quite a match. What is Altidore thinking? They just need to not lose by too many goals. They had the advantage coming in the first leg, so why does he even get involved? And then Sebastian Giovinco gets a yellow in the second half for dissent, means that he will miss the first game of the semifinal. What were they thinking? You're right. It was a wild and interesting game, but didn't turn out very well for either side, even the winning side.
I will say it was very aggressive. But to get a yellow card at halftime in the tunnel, like, come on, guys. Like, just let it go. Like, just go and play the game and leave it all on the field. I think that, like, that to me is just absolutely absurd.
For me, the interesting one is Seattle, though. Seattle has struggled through the season a little bit, typically a very strong side in the Western Conference. Didn't perform that well this year, but 2-0 win over Vancouver with two goals by none other than the villain, Clint Dempsey.
My favorite.
Good to see him scoring goals at the ripe old age of 106. So
kind of like our Peter Benson, no?
Right. I think that he turned 88 like a month ago, so I think he's probably 94 by now. But that aside, good to see Clint scoring goals. Seattle looking good headed into the semis.
Now, what team of the four do you guys think will win the MLS Cup?
I've said before, I think Toronto.
Even with that nonsense in the last game, you think that they can overcome that, or?
Yeah. I mean, all season long, we've questioned whether they are the best of all time. So, I think they're going to win.
That's fair. You don't just lose that overnight. For me, I'm sticking with Seattle.
All right.
If only because I always talk about the culture of MLS on the left coast. The left coast, yes. So, okay. I was talking about Portland last week.
I don't know what's wrong with Jared.
We're just not good at geography here.
I talked about Portland last week, but after that performance by Seattle, I'm thinking that maybe they will have the edge headed into the semifinals.
I'm going with the dark horse and Columbus Crew. You know, beating NYCFC, taking down the big giant. I think they're going to take down the biggest giant in the East in Toronto, and they're going to bring that momentum into the MLS Cup. What a storyline if they'd win it, and then their owners are like, okay, good win, let's move to Texas.
Oh, Texas. I miss it. Now, moving on to world soccer, there's another busy week of international fixtures, which means our 10 things you need to know are pretty packed with some Champions League action, as well as plenty of what's going on in Europe's top five leagues. We'll begin with marquee matchup in the midweek action is Tottenham's stunned reigning champions Real Madrid 3-1 in London. Spurs dominated Los Blancos from start to finish as Madrid's frustrating start to the season continues. With the result, Tottenham have now made the knockout stages of the tournament for the first time since 2010, and Jared is over here looking at me extremely happy right now.
Last week I said that the second best thing for Barcelona fans to a Barcelona win was when Real Madrid loses. If we're getting a little more specific, the best thing for Barcelona fans is a win in El Clasico. But for me personally, the second best thing amongst all these great things I've spoken of is when Tottenham beats Real Madrid.
Even better.
Watch the game.
So specific.
Tottenham just really crushed the Blancos for the first 70 minutes. As a Tottenham fan, they're now 4 points into this group of death, undefeated despite playing Real twice in the group stage, already played Dortmund. It's really good to see that Tottenham is affirming their place as a top side, even on the European stage, and also good to see that Madrid are choking. Love that.
Is that what I sound like every week?
About Liverpool?
No,
yes.
I usually sound way more desperate.
Anyways, now that four games have been played in every Champions League group, other teams that have guaranteed a trip to the round of 16 are Manchester United, PSG, and Manchester City. Speaking of Man City, their star striker, Sergio Aguero, broke the all-time club goal scoring record with his 178th goal against Napoli midweek. He overtook Eric Brooks' record set back in 1940. That's a long time. There are reports that West Ham manager Slaven Bilic will be sacked after 4-1 defeat to Liverpool. The Hammers sit in the relegation zone with 9 points after 11 games. Reports suggest that former Everton and Manchester United boss David Moyes will take over at the East London club.
West Ham, East London, very difficult to kind of get a grasp at where they stand in the Premier League. They were relegated about 6 or 7 years ago. They're now playing in London Stadium, which hosted the 2012, that was the Olympic Stadium back then. They hadn't gotten higher than 15th this season. Definitely a managerial change needs to happen. David Moyes did very well at Everton, not so well at United. Maybe should have been given more time. But I just quickly want to touch on Liverpool because...
Of course. We can't go a week without Will talking about Liverpool.
I think that was a whole 30 seconds without talking about Liverpool. I'm proud of you, Will. I am.
They did win 4-1 away from home. They've, you know, midweek win 3-0 against Maribor. That's what we call a winning streak. And definitely in Northwest England, we have a lot of hope right now that we might finish in the top four. So come on, you Reds.
I'm glad you have hope. It'll be particularly glorious when it gets ripped away.
When it's no longer there. Blockbuster Premier League Sunday saw four home teams win as two of the top six faced off against each other. The Spurs eked past Crystal Palace 1-0 before Arsenal were dismantled 3-1 by rampant Manchester City. Everton came back from 2-0 down to win 3-2 despite Watford missing a 99th-minute penalty. Manchester United, they lost 1-0 to Chelsea at Stamford Bridge to give City an 8-point lead at the top of the Premier League. In Spain, Barcelona maintained their 4-point lead of La Liga after 2-1 win over Sevilla. Paco Alcacer scored both for the Catalonian club, who are now on a 16-game unbeaten streak in all competitions. Real Madrid bounced back from the midweek loss with a 3-0 victory against Las Palmas, while Valencia continued their unbeaten start to the season with a 3-0 win against Leganés. The gap at the top of the table still remains 4 points between Valencia and Barcelona. Madrid are 8 points off the pace. Bayern Munich beat Borussia Dortmund 3-1 at Westfalenstadion. Goals from Robin, Lewandowski, and Alaba were enough to open up a 6-point gap between the two teams in the Bundesliga. Monaco attempted to keep pace with PSG in Ligue 1 with a 6-0 victory against Guingamp, but the Parisians put on their own show with a 5-0 thumping of Angers to maintain their 4-point lead of the French top division. There was a tightening atop the Italian Serie A as Napoli struggled to a 0-0 tie with Chievo, with Juventus able to snatch a 2-1 win over Benevento. There's now a single point separating the first two of them in the table. Now we're going to take a quick break before our special guest takes us into our final segment of the Stoppage Time.
If this voice is unfamiliar, it's because it's supposed to be. I'm Peter Benson, lead producer for The Orange Card, and I'm going to take us into this final stoppage time. All season they've been making jokes about my age. I am actually 26, going on 45, and I'm just here to take us into the final stoppage time. Look, I'm going to try and avoid gushing here, but this podcast has been a blast. But with both the Syracuse men and women done until next fall, we've made a decision not to continue with The Orange Card. We always intended for Syracuse soccer to be the cornerstone of our product. And while we've covered soccer around the US and world, it feels right to close the book on this chapter of our first podcast. As such, this is our final period of stoppage time. In this segment, we've talked about some big issues. Jared kicked us off discussing women in sports and sports media. And last week, Will talked about the hope youth is bringing to a moribund football nation in England. In between, Erin's given us an insight into the practical application of sports psychology, and Tyler mused about what the sport of soccer has meant in terms of the important relationships in our life. Even senior producer Jose Cuevas joined us for a special post-World Cup qualification deep dive into the systematic problems that face US soccer going forward. So to continue the tradition of picking a topic, I'm going to talk about teamwork. It takes a team to win. Despite similar levels of failure, the Syracuse men and women varied in terms of expectation. The lost season for the men was hugely disappointing because coming into the year, it felt like that team could compete. Their disjointed style lacked a certain level of cohesiveness that was ultimately their downfall. We see the men around campus and their camaraderie is unquestioned, but their lack of teamwork on the field, particularly through poor defensive movement and gaping holes in the midfield, meant they were doomed to fail. The women, on the other hand, worked well together on the field and ground out a lot of positive results and performances against superior technical opposition. Gritty performances against Clemson and Miami showed the women could compete. Even in a tough loss against Duke, one of the best teams in the country, the women played well enough to feel like they belonged. Coach Whedon's first full ACC class just graduated, and you could see the commitment to each other he had instilled in his players. They worked together well this year, and if that culture is maintained, the women could be looking at competing for a spot in the ACC tournament very soon, as we just talked about. It is the team that makes it. Bill Simmons let everyone in on basketball's secret in his book about the sport. It's not one or two very good players, it's about the sacrifices that everyone on the team makes. It is about the commitment to the cause of winning that results in the championship. This is not only a lesson in basketball or even sports, but in every endeavour in life. The reason this project has worked for us is the sacrifices the entire team has made. Erin fighting through headaches and balancing a heavy workload to be here every Sunday. Tyler suffered a coffin fit halfway through recording, was sick and came back, refusing to leave halfway through. Jared has had some extremely long nights editing, wrestling with ums, ahs and volume levels to give you listeners the experience you've become accustomed to. One episode even took over 5 hours, and you'll never see that. And Will has held us all together, remaining his level-headed self and allowing all of us to break around him while remaining the rock we've all needed, despite to the detriment of probably his sleeping pattern and his health. It was all of these sacrifices that got us to the end of the run intact, producing something that we're all happy week on week. We have all assumed our roles and played them to perfection. We have all made sacrifices to the detriment of ourselves for the common goal of appeasing our listener. That's right, I said listener every week. All joking aside, this podcast wouldn't have been possible without us all banding together and taking ownership of our roles within the machine. It's sad it's coming to an end, but also hopeful as it's given us all the tools and the confidence to make another one. Saying that, I'd like to formally announce that some of the team will be back in mid-January with an international soccer-focused podcast under a different name, so you can all look out for that. If you stay subscribed to us on iTunes, information will be made available in that feed near the time. And so for one last time, I'd like to say a big thank you to our team. Jared.
Thank you, Peter.
Will.
Thanks, Peter.
Aaron.
Thanks, Peter.
And of course, Tyler.
Thanks, Peter.
We've been the Orange Card. We'll see you soon.